So it is time once again to ask a few questions about vehicle well-being. Is something bothering your car? Are you hearing a wobble or a whine where there should be a hum? Our next guest has heard many of these over the years. Zach Edwards is the owner of Ashland Automotive, and he's our partner in a monthly segment we call The Squeaky Wheel. In this context, you are the squeaky wheel. Give us a call or email to talk about automotive issues you had or are currently having. Again, 800-838-3760 or jx@jeffnet.org. We try to keep this fairly topical to season. And we had been talking about the cooling system, and there's lots more questions I have there. But why don't we go straight to the question I'm sure a lot of people think about, which is the air quality coming into the car. And I guess we'll start with the inside of the car, with the people first. We'll deal with the engine second. So if you got your car closed, air conditioner running, and the how is the air quality for the people in that car in the smoking conditions we've been having in the region?
That's a really great question. I think the preferred way to drive your car right now would be with the windows up and the air conditioning on, like you just suggested, with the caveat that their older cars on the road don't have any filtration for the cabin air, and so the air being pushed around inside the car.
Let me guess, something 98 or before?
It's in the early 2000s, I think most cars started having what's called a cabin air filter or a pollen filter. And what that does is it, you know, the blower inside the ductwork is either going to suck air in from outside or it's going to recirculate the air that's already inside the car and push it back through. And so by having the recirculation setting activated on your controls there and having the windows up, you're essentially pushing all the air inside the car through the filter before it goes back out into the cabin area again. And it's also a really nice trick to make your air conditioning work better because you're cooling air that's already been cooled instead of trying to cool fresh or, in quotes, fresh air from outside,
but certainly
you know,
95-degree
air, you know, in the afternoon. And so, these cabin air filters and pollen air filters are a huge improvement to quality of air inside the car. And when they started being put in cars, I think it was a great idea.
So where, I mean, even with those systems, with the filters, though, I mean, they got to be bringing in air in from someplace. It's got to be a little outside air coming in, because otherwise you'd starve yourself of oxygen over time, wouldn't you, in a super-sealed car?
Yeah, so cars actually have, and you can't usually see them, but they have these little air outlets that allow you to shut your door. Otherwise, it would be a...
Or rather, you'd blow the windows out.
Yeah, you'd have negative pressure in there, and the doors wouldn't shut right. And so it's funny if you see a car on the production line before all the glass is installed and the doors are on there, you can actually see the little air. They're basically vents. And so I think when you're in the recirculation mode and the blower is just pumping the air round and round, it does have to draw from somewhere, but it's pretty slight. And the air does get filtered through that pollen filter.
So we're talking about the pollen filter in the air conditioning system in the car. And are these filters that need to be changed out every so often, or can they be washed?
Sure. Yeah, they need to be changed at scheduled intervals. Usually, if you're following your maintenance schedule, you know, your 15,000-mile service or your 30 or 45, they're usually in 15,000-mile increments. But every so often, they'll call for that filter to be changed. And then in, you know, periods like this around here, I think everybody's going to want to have that filter changed after the smoke season is over, whether, you know, it's calling for on a schedule or not. I'm certainly going to change mine and also my engine air filter, because these filters filter in parts per million. So they do a really good job of trapping these particles, and they can be 25-30% clogged and still look totally normal. You can't wait for them to be discolored. By the time they're discolored, they're extremely plugged.
Okay, so by the time your air filter looks bad, it's time to go.
Yeah, right. Yeah. It's just like your home, you know, your HVAC at home too. They say every 90 days for those filters, and you know, you look at it and you think, oh, it looks pretty clean. I think I'll just leave it there. I don't want to get out the ladder, but it really does help to change them.
Zach Edwards is back with the squeaky wheel here on the Jefferson Exchange. He's the owner of Ashland Automotive. We can take your car care questions by phone or by email, 800-838-3760. By phone, by email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So given the smoky conditions, I mean, are we talking shortening the cycle by half or something when of the air filter?
It's really hard to tell. I don't think I could say for sure, but I think if an air filter might last a couple years in good clean air, and if you're not driving regularly on dusty road conditions, I think I would replace my air filter after 3 months of this type of weather, because you can see the particulates in the air. In the morning, you come out to the car, you can see the ash on your hood and on the window sills. I can just see it kind of building up. So I definitely would recommend everybody change their filters at the end of this smoke season.
Of course, we live in a dusty place anyway, because the summers are so dry in the Rogue Valley in particular, and there are lots of the region that are like this, if not somewhat drier, as you start heading east of the Cascades and south of the Siskiyous, for example. So, I mean, given the general dusty conditions, is this a place where air filters die a little sooner anyway?
Yeah. Yep. This is, for the scheduled, the manufacturer's maintenance schedule for cars, they usually do two different schedules. One is for regular service and one is for severe service. And the severe service versus regular service is determined by geographic location. And the Rogue Valley certainly qualifies as severe service just due to our heat. Like you said, the environmental conditions around here qualify as a severe service. I think, maybe Nebraska or Iowa wouldn't be severe service, although it gets very cold over there, and that can be hard on a car. But here with the mountains and the type of driving people do, pulling these very steep grades is really hard on a car. And so the maintenance schedule for those cars in this area is a little more extensive.
So let's come to the actual combustion going on inside the engine then, because we're trying to make sure that air stays as clean as possible. But I mean, I have to believe a few things get past the filter from time to time. I mean, do we get dust and smoke particles and stuff into the cylinders of the car?
One would hope not. It's sealed off. The clamps that hold the ducting and the tubing together, they have to be very tight, or the car is going to realize there's a problem, because of the car is measuring the amount of air going into the engine. And so if there's any air escaping into the engine that's not measured, the computer is likely going to figure that out pretty quickly. So all the air that goes into the engine is, in theory, is filtered, and it's a pretty tight system. So that's why it's so important when you're making an internal engine repair and you have an engine, say a cylinder head taken off, it's really important to have a clean facility and keep everything covered up really well. And because even small particulates get in there, can create big problems at these revolutions per minute. The piston going up and down thousands of times in a minute is it's a lot of friction.
In super close tolerances too, as you pointed out. I mean, what do we talk about the gap between the piston and the cylinder wall there?
Yeah, that it's just getting tighter all the time. I know bearing clearances are now in 10/1000ths of an inch.
Wow, really?
Yeah, so the I'm not sure about the clearance between the piston and the cylinder wall anymore. It's pretty tight, and for all intents and purposes, they're touching. They're basically touching.
Just with a thin film of oil between them?
Exactly, yeah. And with the piston, there's rings on the outside. So the piston is smaller than, the diameter of the piston is smaller than the diameter of the cylinder, such that the piston rings, they're just a little bit wider than the piston itself. And so the rings are actually scraping up and down on the cylinder walls. And there's that film of oil, like you said, that keeps scoring from happening. But if a condition leads to scoring, it's instantaneous. The damage is quick.
I can see why at that speed, at that pressure, a dust bunny becomes fatal perhaps to an engine.
Exactly. And that's why, keeping your oil clean and changed and full is so critical.
So what are the gaps on that right now? 3,000 miles, or has it gone up depending on type of engine, type of oil?
It depends a lot. There's a lot of misinformation or maybe not very good information out there. I know BMW, a lot of European cars are now calling for 10,000 plus miles in between oil changes. And although that might be okay, it always makes us nervous because then nobody's really popping the hood, looking under there, looking at the other fluid levels for 10,000 miles. Also, it depends on the type of driving you do. So if you do a lot of highway driving, that's much easier on engine oil than the stop and go, in-town traffic driving. That if you're doing mostly that type of driving, you're going to want to change your oil more frequently. So, the rule of thumb, I think, for a lot of the Asian cars now is they say 7,500. A lot of the Euro cars is 10,000. If we're doing a synthetic oil change at the shop, we call for 5,000 just to be safe, and then we try and tell the customer, if you're doing mostly highway driving, you can go a little longer, but just be aware of it starting at about 5,000 miles, and then, you make the call. You might want to check your oil level once in between, and a lot of people just aren't going to do that. And so that's one of our other concerns, is nobody's popping the hood on their car anymore, and I don't blame them.
As good as the car is at maintaining itself and keeping track of its own systems, it's going to give you a light at some point or give you some error code. But
a lot of cars don't even have a dipstick anymore. You just can't check your own oil. Yeah. So it's just an electronic display that says the oil level is full, and it's using an electronic sensor mounted on the oil pan that measures the level. And so you don't really need to pop the hood anymore as a end user.
Wow, the surprises continue on the squeaky wheel. What's going on with your car or truck? Throw a question to Zach Edwards from Ashland Automotive. We'd love to hear from you at 800-838-3760 by phone. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. I must admit, I'm still getting used to the idea after all these years of computers and cars. And when you say things like what you said before about the cars measuring the air, there's just so much that the computers monitor, and it must be a very different thing to work on a car now when the car can, in essence, tell you what's wrong with it, or at least tell you where there's a problem.
Yep, it can tell you where it hurts. So that's what we always liken this to the medical experience. And if you go to the doctor and you have a stomach ache, the doctor's still going to need to run some tests. That's a simplified example, but that's kind of what the car's computer can do. It can say, look, there's a problem over here. We don't know exactly what it is, but this is where you should look first. And then the technician is going to go in there and run a couple of tests and verify that indeed that's the area where the problem exists and what exactly is the problem. Sometimes the computer, it's still just using an algorithm, and sometimes it can erroneously point to the wrong direction. But with the evolution of engineering, getting better and better all the time, the car does get better and better at pointing to the right area and being a little more specific with each new model year. The ability to self-diagnose is getting better all the time. And it's just a huge help. There was some mystery years there where the driving technology was actually had surpassed the self-diagnostic technology. And those were really tough years for technicians because the car couldn't talk, but it had all of this technology operating, and the technician had to be really, really up to speed in real time to be able to figure out what was going on during those years.
Are there many more sensors now than there used to be then? I mean, in addition to the computer getting better, and computers obviously all over the planet getting just better and more knowledgeable, are there more things that they track too?
Oh yeah, there's hundreds and hundreds of sensors now, if not thousands. Every single function on the car is basically being monitored. Even power window operation, it's going to know when the window is up because it's going to sense that excessive amperage draw from trying to close a window that has no more travel left, and it's going to shut that power window motor down based off of that amp draw. And it's a circuit breaker, but it's probably a transistor inside of the power window motor, and that essentially is a sensor.
Let's take some questions here. We have a couple people on the line. Let's start with Robin in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Zach Edwards from Ashland Automotive.
Oh, thank you, thank you, thank you for taking my call. So, listen, my question is, I bought a Ford F-350 truck, 1992. It's got a lot of power and it's everything that I need, except that this thing is lifted. And I'm wondering, am I going to get into trouble at some point in the future? I want to be able to tow a travel trailer. So I'm wondering, should I start saving my pennies to get this thing back to stock, or will I be able to just use whatever hitch is level with the trailer and keep the truck the way it is?
All right. Well, sounds like a good vehicle to tow with, Robin. That's a pretty powerful vehicle, like you said. I think what you're just going to want to do is get what's called a drop hitch, and it's a hitch that will go on. And I don't know how big your lift is, but it doesn't matter. You can just get the appropriate drop, and that will lower the ball on the hitch down to the right size. And depending on how big your travel trailer is, it might be a real nice fit. I mean, if you have a really long and heavy tongue weight on the trailer, that might be perfect for what you need. So I think you'll just have to size it up and then go to any truck or RV store in Medford, and they'll be able to get you the right size.
But the point is to get the trailer level, not to have it hiked back with the sticking up.
The other thing I guess you should consider, make sure that sometimes when vehicles are lifted, the alignment angles, well, not sometimes, all the time, when you lift a vehicle, the alignment angles change. And so you just want to make sure that your alignment is correct, and you can get that checked at a shop or at a Les Schwab or something. And because if you don't have the right alignment angles with a lifted vehicle, you're just going to chew up tires. So that would be the other recommendation I would have.
Robin, thanks for the question. Very much appreciate it. Let's move on to the squeaky wheel to Glenn in Medford. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Zach Edwards.
Hey, Glenn.
I have two questions involving fuel. My wife has a 2002 Thunderbird. It specifies unleaded premium, but it also says no fuel containing methanol. Am I correct that methanol is banned from fuels now?
I thought it was ethanol that we're using in the wintertime. Is that right?
Yeah, I think it's ethanol. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure about the methanol. I think there was a period there where we used methanol, but the real point there is that you want to use the premium fuel because it says so inside the gas flap, and that's where anybody who's wondering what type of fuel, you know, what octane level to use, it's going to say inside that gas flap. And that 92 Thunderbird, it might be supercharged, that engine, but it has a high compression ratio. And when you have a high compression ratio, you need a higher octane, which is going to slow down the burn rate. And that's going to prevent pinging from happening inside the combustion chamber. And the pinging kind of sounds like marbles in a can. And that's when anytime you have that happen, you're running the risk of burning stuff up inside the combustion chamber. And so it's, you know, it's unfortunate you got to pay more at the pump, but you got to pay to play to have a fancy performing engine like in a 1992 Thunderbird.
And as I look to Glenn,
it's an O2.
Oh, an O2. Yeah, sorry.
All right. So, yeah, what I'm seeing, Glenn, here is that methanol is rarely used, it looks like, for anything but racing cars in America.
The other question I have, it says it's not designed to use metallic compounds within fuel additives. And they specifically mention manganese-based compounds containing MMT. I have no way to determine that when buying fuel.
All right, so what do you know about metals and fuels? Thanks for that, Glenn.
Well, there's a lot of additives they're putting in fuels now. You know, I would probably direct you, because that sounds pretty specific. You could call your Ford dealership and ask them. But my guess is any name brand fuel, and by name brand, I'm thinking of, you know, Chevron or Texaco or Shell, ConocoPhillips.
Were you at the oil company name on the station?
Yeah, any of those higher quality, those are higher quality fuels without a doubt. You can get, you know, the discount fuels. They're going to be, I'm not going to name names there, but you can know which ones are discount fuels because they're far less expensive than some of the name brand ones. But I think if you stick with those name brand fuels and you put in a premium blend, it's going to be fine for that car.
Thanks again, Glenn. Appreciate that. This is the Squeaky Wheel on the Jefferson Exchange. And Randy in Medford, Randy in Rouge, sorry, says, my wife's Mini has a squeaking sound coming from the left rear. We hear it when the suspension moves up and down. Is there a lubricant we could use to eliminate the squeak?
Probably not. You know, it's a suspension-related noise, and those can be difficult to pinpoint, but generally there's nothing back there that needs lubricated. So probably just something worn out. It just happens over time, and, you know, you just want to bring it into your favorite place and have them take a look.
Just enough time for one more question. Let's go back to the cooling system because we never got to talk about electric fans last time you were here, about the difference between the electric fans and the belt-driven ones, and is there any particular advantage?
Yeah, most cars are going to the electric fan because that fan is controllable by the computer, and it only needs to come on when necessary. And so in the constant quest to reduce drag on the engine, the car is only turning on loads when necessary, and the cooling fan is a huge load. When that thing starts spinning, it's pulling a lot of amperage, which makes the alternator, which is still belt-driven, makes the alternator have to produce more power, and that drags down the engine. And so the electric fan, for one, it saves a lot of space, it saves a lot of weight, and it doesn't run unless it needs to run. And so most cars have two or maybe three electric fans that they're using now for the air conditioning and the radiator combination.
Lots of electricity getting used under the hood.
Yeah, lots of plastic, too.
Right. Zach Edwards is our guest once a month for a segment we call the Squeaky Wheel. He's the proprietor of Ashland Automotive. Thanks again so much for joining us.
Good to see you
in the new
Jeff.
Studio.
Yeah, thanks. This place is great.